Welcome everyone, it's the Auckland Cricket Podcast. My name is Ian Lexon and tonight I am joined by Neil Gray and PJ Veneman. Welcome gents.
Good evening.
Hello.
Right, it's a wee bit old, but we're going to start off with the Black Caps announcement to Zimbabwe. They announced a couple of sides last week, which was the 2020 and one day squad plus the test squad, and some interesting names in there. Graham Aldridge, just before he gets his senior citizens bus pass, gets selected for the Black Caps, and Doug Bracewell, one of 67 Bracewells that have played for New Zealand, gets called up for both of those sides. Rob Nicol finally gets his chance, Dean Brownlee gets another go, and the long lost Jeetan Patel are sort of the shock. So what do we make of all that, guys? Do we like those picks? Are they bold? Are they stupid? Are they, well, what are they?
Well, what's the reason behind a few of them? Because a few of those guys haven't got central contracts. Are there injuries or?
Aldridge is potentially cover for Southee, who is going to be in the test lineup, but is still recovering from injury, so I don't think he's going to make the short form of the stuff early doors. Bracewell, I just think they didn't think they're going to play him enough to warrant a central contract, but now they've changed their mind. He did really well on the Emerging Players Tour in Australia. That's the reasons that they're giving for picking him.
Aldridge, bit of a leap. I'm not really sure if covering for Southee, okay. I think there's better out there, but probably trying to set some kind of precedent for rewarding people. Bracewell deserves a shot. I thought he was unlucky not to get a central contract. Nicol got a central contract and has deserved a shot for a long time. Brownlee was another one who did well in the A Tour. And then I'm totally against picking Jeetan Patel. Like, so much against it, it's almost like Jamie and Jacob Oram. But they've given a reason that he did well when he went to play for Warwickshire. So, I mean, he is coming.
Who do you think should be there instead of?
Any one of Bruce Martin, Todd Astle, or there was another one that was I had ahead of him, but it slipped my mind at the minute.
It does seem to be a wee bit going back to the old tried and true without looking sort of elsewhere of people who have done well, particularly last season. I guess they've also looked at, and John Wright says in there that they're taking Rob Nicol as a distinctly spin option. In fact, he mentions his spinning abilities more so than he does his batting, which is, I found interesting.
Good decision, I think. I like Rob Nicol as an all-rounder.
I think he's great. I mean, he had an awesome year last year. I couldn't believe they didn't take him to the World Cup, really. I think it's long overdue, so I hope he does really well.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kane Williamson hasn't really stepped up as a spin bowler, and I know he's young and he hasn't been at that level for very long, but it's good to have a second spin option there, and I think might see a lot of bowling from Rob Nicol.
Okay, so they're going to Zimbabwe. They're playing, you see, a series of one day and 2020 stuff. They're playing some test matches. Zimbabwe just come out of a series against Pakistan, which they lost. Before that, they beat up Bangladesh. So what can we expect, do you think, guys? Is this just another disaster waiting, banana skin waiting to be fallen over by the Black Caps, or should we go over there and pummel them?
Nah, I think they seem pretty well prepared, and John Wright, they've had a pretty good run at this and a good break for most of them, so I think they should be okay.
Yeah, I think we'll beat them soundly. I don't think it's going to be the tests anyway. I don't think we'll be traditional type tests, because the Zimbabweans will probably play five spinners and we'll take them apart at the top of the order, and I don't think it's going to be traditional test match cricket by any means.
Yeah, I think the test matches will definitely be outright.
Okay. And last time we went over there, Shane Bond blitzed them to pieces. Don't really have anybody of his ilk now. I guess Southee will be there for those matches. So it'd be interesting to see. In that press release that came out with that, we had somebody quoted, a guy by the name of Kim Littlejohn, who is a new member of the NZD staff. He's the new national selector manager. Sorry. He has an interesting background, and much has been talked of it already, so we won't go into too much detail. But he's come from Bowls Australia and pretty much has no background in cricket whatsoever, apart from playing the game, I think, at a fairly early age. So I guess it raises that whole question of, if you're picking somebody for a role such as this, is it vital that they're actually a former domestic or international cricketer?
The way they've described the role needing to be done, probably not. It is more of an administrative role. Like, his last job was with Bowls, but he does have a background in other high performance sport areas, and I guess it's more an attitude thing when you get to that level that's really a difference maker between a lot of people, and ultimately John Wright's still going to have the final say. I still think they passed over some good options, but who knows, judge him in a couple of years, I suppose.
He's going to be a busy guy if he does all that he's meant to be doing in terms of talking to every single domestic coach and getting their ideas on every player and then getting up to speed with every player that they're talking about and judging their opinions versus what they he thinks they're saying and what they whether they've got any bias involved in terms of their own players, etc., etc.
I mean, how you can hold someone accountable, how he can be judged, I struggle to understand. What are his KPIs? How does he pass or fail being national selection manager?
I think he's going to have some very detailed ones, actually. We talked to John Buchanan a little while ago, and he's coming up with some quite intricate statistical measures of how you can gauge the success of individual players and then as a team overall. It's going to be quite quantifiable.
But that's what I mean. So he's going to be judged based on the players?
I don't know. That was, I guess, more on Black Cat performance and how they did over a year and so forth.
His fate is basically intricately tied in with John Wright's then? You
potentially.
Can't hold the selection manager, or can you?
What are the criteria do you base it on?
Well, they've said that Wright has the final say. So if Wright goes, then it's the selector guy.
Maybe he has stuff around how he manages people.
It's just another interesting Buchananism set up. It's hard to judge how it'll work.
He's either going to be a genius or the worst thing that happened to New Zealand cricket, really, in a couple of years' time, isn't he?
I'm not really sure exactly what his role entails. It sounds a little bit ambiguous, as Neil was saying, as to how he's going to be measured. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as Neil said, if the selections ultimately lie with John Wright, the only way he can be judged is if he finds, by chance, some young gun in domestic cricket and brings him through, and that pick's attributed to him having discovered him or having a part in discovering him. I don't really know.
All right, well, we'll await with interest, see what happens there. Man who won't be around to follow that and see what happens, well, not at New Zealand cricket, is Justin Vaughan, the CEO, who announced his resignation last week, I think, to a fair bit of shock in quite a few circles. We're probably not going to go into that into too much detail, but he's been around for 4.5 years. And any comments on what you think his legacy is going to be from those 4.5 years? It's been a pretty tumultuous time one way or another, and what's been going on around the Black Caps while he's been in that hot seat.
I mean, the legacy that you'll leave for most people won't be a good one, I don't think. Just the layman who'll look at it about what happened to Bondi and stuff with the ICL and the decision to hire Andy Moles and then to go with the captain as the de facto coach, and just all seem very disorganised. Probably not a good one, but then there's all the other stuff that he's done behind the scenes that most people probably wouldn't appreciate, like the collective bargaining agreement with the players and the benefits that the work he's done in America could potentially bring.
Hmm.
For very little cost, and the financial solid base that gives New Zealand cricket.
He's increased revenue, I think, by 60% in the time he's been in the job, which is not an inconsiderable achievement. But you're right, I think on the face of it, it could paint a pretty dire picture of his tenure if he just took those things into account. I think it's a bit more 50-50.
He's probably had a part in bringing the World Cup here, so
yeah.
I'm surprised that he didn't stick around for that. Maybe he knows something that we all don't about how that World Cup's going to go.
I think he stated in his reasons for leaving is that New Zealand cricket needed somebody who was going to be here right through until that point. And I guess he's been there 4 years. That's another 4 years down the track. That's a long time to be in the same job. And he probably didn't see himself. He might have seen himself there for another year or two, but not for another 4 years maybe. And so maybe that's the reason halfway stepped aside. So anyway, so they're looking for a new CEO. So if you fancy your chances and think you know a bit about cricket, then maybe you want to get hold of New Zealand cricket and chuck them your CV.
If you don't get that one, you can always be the CEO of Cricket Wellington.
Yeah, it's a tumultuous time around the cricket world at the moment. CEOs are dropping like flies. Fortunately, we've just managed to appoint one. Maybe we should mention that, actually. We've got Mark Cameron on board, who at the moment, for the next month or so anyway, is the CEO for the Northern Mystics netball franchise, but we'll have his feet under the desk at Auckland Cricket by November the 7th. So exciting times for us. And yeah, if you don't get the New Zealand job, then yeah, redirect it to Wellington instead. They'll be looking too.
I heard Mark Richardson on Crowd Goes Wild say that he was going to submit his CV.
Really? Did he say it with a big grin on his face or just a small one?
No, it was kind of a deadpan. So, you know, he could have been serious.
The actual bookie's favourite for the New Zealand job is the Northern Districts CEO.
David Cooper, yes.
So you could then just apply for the Northern Districts job.
Could be the eternal merry-go-round.
Just set up a template, a CEO application template. just change the address.
Yeah, David Cooper replied last time that when Justin Vaughan got it, actually, and I think came pretty close, so he could be a big candidate, who knows. And there's a couple of other ex-New Zealand players out in that CEO around major associations such as Lee Jamon. It was Gavin Larson, but not anymore.
Hilarious if one of the guys that got sacked as the selectors got it. Hilarious.
That would be
hilarious.
Some, yes. Some wonderful irony, I guess, in that one. Yeah. Alright, let's get down to some Auckland stuff, and painful as it is, I think we need to talk about the Champions League, because last time we were with you, we were going hell-bent on every single team and doing it to death. It was a sad couple of days, it really was. It was absolutely gutting. But and in case you haven't caught up with it, if you've been buried in Rugby World Cup and you just have no idea what
shame,
we're talking about.
Shame on you.
Yeah, that's pretty bad to start with, and why are you listening to this podcast? But if you have missed it, Aces missed out on the last ball in each game, trying to chase down 122 against Kolkata and then trying to defend 125 against Somerset. And yes, say, last ball losses, both cruel, cruel indeed. Looked like they're pretty average pitches that they're playing on over there each time, but that's not necessarily an excuse. Neil, you were Facebooking ball-by-ball coverage and watched the whole thing.
All 120 balls of both games.
Yes.
Plus.
Well, hold on, that's 240 each game. But anyway, we won't trip you up on your maths. You're probably still tired from watching it.
True.
What did you make of it? Where did you think we went wrong?
It just hurts. It hurts even thinking about it. The Kolkata game, where did we go wrong? Well, Guppy getting run up first ball didn't help. We bowled real well. Like, we came back really, really well in that game. They got off to a flyer. And then the last 10 overs, Batesy was unbelievable. And the fielding was really good. And that was a good total on that wicket. And we should have got it easy. And then Guppy getting out first ball. And then I thought we got back in it well with Lou and Jimmy. And then Tan just killed it in the middle. They just bang, bang, bang. Hoppy, Rob Quiney, and someone else all just, ball just holding up in the wickets. And they just chipped it back just behind the eight ball, and then we got it back. Then the Sky TV coverage cut out, and I was like, no, what's happening?
That was horrendous, wasn't it? I was trying to like get onto Cricket Info or something, anything they had it while they were trying to get the coverage back on air.
And
yeah,
then,
worst
yeah,
possible time for a break in coverage.
We just didn't get that spin part in the middle, which was just ideal bowling for those wickets. And probably Ronnie would admit that he didn't bowl very well in the first innings, and we missed our chance to really throttle them with spin. We only had one spinner, which I would probably pick Danaru.
Do you think that probably hurt us in the second game, where, you know, again, we struggled to set a decent total, but we got over the 120 mark.
Yeah.
They got off to a good start. We picked up the wickets. We had them 65 for 4, I think it was.
Yeah.
And that's the time, and those middle overs seem to be where you need those guys taking
yeah,
all the pace off the ball. You really need at
and
least
the,
a couple of
the
spinners.
Other advantage is
and they got
just,
back into it.
It just gets through the overs a bit quicker as well. Like, there's just not as much time.
Because
none of the seamers that we have incredibly short run-ups. They've all got decent length
yeah,
run-ups. Whereas guys, someone like Andrew Kitchen would just have gone bang, bang, bang. And they might not have been the greatest six balls, but they might only have gone for six runs. Plus the over would have been over. So when they need nine and over, it would just keep everything going a bit quicker.
It's quite noticeable, though. I was just reading something today about the games that are now in the main tournament, and it's pretty noticeable that scores, especially in Hyderabad, but also in one of the other centres, I can't remember which now, pretty low, 120 to 140.
Yeah.
And the commentary in that report was very much that first five overs, everybody's booming it, and often, you know, 40, maybe even 50 without many down. Then the ball softens up, and suddenly it just run rate absolutely dives through the floor,
yeah,
and nobody can hit it anywhere. Pretty much exactly the same pattern as we saw in both the Aces games. So they're not the easiest tracks.
I mean,
to
be fair to Somerset, we wrote them off pretty hard in the last pod. They have a team of virtual nobodies apart from Van der Merwe, who's booming it, but they've got a couple of handy young guys that have done real well, the leggy and the young batter, and it's pretty impressive.
Potentially proves the worth of coming straight off the back of a season, really, doesn't it? I think it's very hard to come out of a winter where, sure, you've been doing a lot of training and getting up to speed as much as you can, but
well, they,
nothing
they,
like match
Auckland
practice.
Ended up getting quite a good side there. So, I mean, I understood that that they weren't given the opportunity to go over there. They didn't have windows in their county contracts for this qualifying tournament, but it seems like quite a few of them did make it.
Well, so, county cricket's finished just before, like a few days before the right. start of that tournament, so they did all make it. But, I mean, you look at that side, and yeah, it was a really strong side. So, never mind, they are back, most of them anyway, in New Zealand, and they're gearing up for Plunkett Shield in about 5 or 6 weeks' time. In fact, they just announced the training squad for that, which doesn't contain too many surprises in it. It's got the 12 contracted players, plus the Black Caps, plus 4 other players who are Ronnie Hira, Gareth and Lance Shaw, and
the Ellerslie Wonder Kid, Dean Bartlett.
Yes, in preparation for a Plunkett Shield, which we're sincerely hoping will be better than last year.
One of our loyal listeners.
Yep. Okay, let's leave the Aces there and move on to, let's look at some international cricket that's been going on. And we've made much of Australia's misfortunes over probably the past 6 months because, hey, it's fun. And we don't get to do it that often. We haven't been able to do it that often in the last 10, 15 years, really. But there are series in Sri Lanka. Are we seeing a bit of a rebirth in Aussie cricket and some new blood coming through? They won the Test Series 1-0. I think they won the One Day Series 3-2. I'm not sure how they did in the 2020, actually. If anybody can enlighten me there, please do so. But and people scoring some big runs, Clark getting back into form. I think Ponting scored a few runs in the one-day series. Are we sort of a bit premature in saying that the Aussies are on the downward slide and they're in big trouble?
No, I think they're looking good. I think Ponting not being captain has meant that he can concentrate on his batting, obviously, and he seems to be playing a lot better, and a weight's lifted off his shoulders, and I'm sure that he's still got a massive leadership role in that team, so I think that's worked to their advantage, and they're looking pretty good.
Got a lot of young guys that they're giving a go, and they've done pretty well. Sean Marsh got 100. Khawaja was good without being spectacular. I think they do have a real good unit of young guys coming through. It's just about how they blood them and whether they stick or twist, kind of thing. But I don't think it's the greatest opposition they've been against. I think the real challenge will be when they play South Africa coming up. And the interesting thing is that the guy that from the Argus report, well, I can't even remember his name now, the coach guy.
Tim Nielsen.
So yeah, he underwent the whole Argus review with that axe hanging over his head. The axe fell. He was told he wasn't keeping his job, he had to reapply. Coached the team to this series victory and then said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to go and work for South Australia. And they've now brought Troy Cooley, who seems to still have this reputation of being the magic man, out of the Australian Academy. Made him the interim coach, and he said he's got no intention of applying for the job. So he's now interim coach going to South Africa. He's gone from not being involved at all to back being involved and a selector with Clark on tour. And I guess the most interesting thing in this whole subplot will be whether he can get Mitchell Johnson bowling well again, because he is now almost certainly the weakest link in the Australian bowling attack. So all very interesting, and still not settled, I think, until they get a coach.
He had a horrible time over in Sri Lanka, didn't he, Johnson? Yeah. Barely took a wicket and went for plenty, I think. He's still that hot and cold kind of proposition that could be magic, but more often than not, is far from it. Okay, well, interesting. We will watch. I think you're right. I think that Sri Lankan side, well, we heard about the problems in Sri Lankan cricket when Sangakkara talked about it in that Lord's address, and it's been fairly public about all the financial strife they've been in as well, and I think they're suffering a wee bit in the playing stakes too. So that South African series, which actually should be great. I mean, yeah, looking forward to that. It'll be a real matchup. Speaking of people in strife and people generally shooting themselves in the foot, which Pakistan would have to be the absolute past masters of, it's pretty much crisis is situation normal in that country. And because Waqar Yunus has just resigned as coach, and Shoaib Akhtar has just decided to pitch his 2 cents worth in, probably more like at least 20 cents worth, actually. He's put out a new book, and in it he has some fairly free and frank admissions about ball tampering. And let's see, we're going to quote some of it here. He says, "The game has become very unequal and only favours the batsman. If you bowl a no ball, the batsman gets a free hit. Bounces have been curtailed. They have restricted us so mercilessly that I find it very difficult to feel entirely guilty about ball tampering." So that's fairly clear. Akhtar goes on to describe how the ball can be tampered with. "There are so many ways to prepare the ball. It's not just a matter of scratching it," he wrote. "I have used my boot, nails and zip of my back pocket. Many bowlers use Vaseline or gum on the ball. The only way, and this I think is the crown jewel in the quote, the only way to stop this is for the ICC to ensure that at least some pitches are prepared in favour of bowlers. That seems like the only logical conclusion to that, doesn't it, fellas?
It's just like, I mean, yeah, it's just, it's the same with all these books. He's just trying to drum up a bit of publicity to sell it, and he was always a close to the line character.
He certainly does it. He's not going to sell many copies in India because he's rubbished Tendulkar and Dravid in it as well, and say they only play for themselves.
Well, he went and said in a TV show on some channel somewhere that if they don't like his book, they don't have to spend their money on it. Their choice. It's a very bullish attitude to the whole thing, but.
He's a good character to have around, though. Nothing worse than a boring cricketer. I'm sure it will be a fascinating read.
I missed his retirement.
Probably laugh out loud stuff, I'd imagine, some of that book. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't imagine he'll follow the Imran Khan career path from there.
To would-be president.
Mm.
It'd be interesting to see what the English translation works out as.
Mm.
I'm sure some of
Do you see, actually, another interesting only in Pakistan one. See, there's now a big groundswell of opinion that they need to change the name of the National Cricket Stadium in Lahore, which is the Muammar Gaddafi Cricket Stadium. It was named after the Libyan, ex-Libyan president when he went there in 1979 or 1980, which soon after he was in power, and said nice things about Pakistan, basically. And the then Pakistan president decided that, wow, he's such a good guy, we need to name something after him. So they named the cricket stadium. There's now, considering a fairly recent events, few people saying that maybe it's not quite so appropriate to have our biggest cricket stadium named after this chap. Yeah. So, and they've suggested, just what made me think of that was that they suggested Imran Khan was one of the possible renaming possibilities. But his involvement in politics, I think, is going to rule that one out. The other one that they're talking about is the Alim Dar Stadium. Because he has won. He has apparently won the ICC Best Umpire for 3 years in a row, and I read something that says that Pakistan is, they think this is right up there with Pakistan winning the World Cup. That's how impressed they are by it, which I guess if you've got that much crap going on around your cricket, you probably cling on to that kind of stuff as being world shatteringly good.
They should knight him,
yeah, or whatever they do, or just not behead you or something. Alright, so that's the wonderful world of Pakistan cricket. I think we're just about done for another week, unless you boys have got anything you'd like to add.
I'd
to
just
the mix
like to touch on the fact that England have brought in another South African.
Yes they have. What's this fella's name?
Stuart Meeker, from memory.
Yeah.
Sorry, 90 Ks.
Yeah, he's quick, real quick.
So how many does that make now?
People in glass houses. People in glass houses.
What? You're talking about the ABs or something, aren't you?
No.
No?
What are you talking about? The Black Caps. As soon as Neil Wagner's fit, he'll be in.
He'd be eligible. Yeah, he'd be the first one we have who's not a pure
born
and bred
in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, so was Skippy Sinclair.
Current side.
That would make two.
Yeah, so all I'm
the English side has
it's
got
a foreign
well,
legion.
If you're going to go full on, you're going to go Strauss, Peterson. There's Wayne Pryor as well.
BJ
Trott.
Watling, I don't think he was born in New Zealand.
No, he's South African.
Yeah.
I'll take it. Grant Elliott, South African.
Yeah, he's not in the squad, thank God.
I don't think we can remotely compare ourselves to the England side.
It's getting a little bit ridiculous.
And you've got Morgan as well.
The boundary lines have been blurred. Morgan's an exception, though.
What?
Like saying Ross Taylor. Ross Taylor was born in New Zealand, but
Ross Taylor never played for Samoa in international cricket. Oh, and Morgan played for Ireland for at least a few years.
But not in a.
It's not the same, Neil.
Test match
it's
status.
Not the same.
That's only because his side hasn't got test status. He would have otherwise.
Yeah, true.
Don't try it. Look, it is perfectly valid. So
yeah, South Africa have got a wealth of talent.
We should send this
new national selector manager guy over there.
Yeah, we should be sending some passports over with him, shouldn't we?
I enjoy
it. Look, fellas, it's really nice down here.
I'm enjoying their current brand of cricket.
Oh yeah, so am I. I think they're great. I just think it's a good talking point because you've got to consider where they're coming from.
With these young guys, it's good. And they're only bringing them in little tasters here and there and then send them back.
But you're only good as your last game.
That's what we're doing with Graham
Aldridge. And they lost their last game. So.
Just giving them a wee taste.
At 34.
Yeah.
Just to keep him eager into his 40s.
We're using the treat him mean, keep him keen approach with Graham. We've treated him mean for 15 years. And now we just give him a little sliver of hope. All right. Well, I think that will round us up for another week. We'll be back in a fortnight with everything else that's been happening in the world of cricket. So thanks for listening, and we will catch you then.
Go the Warriors.